And our guest this morning is Pat Dutt. Good morning, Pat.
Morning. Thank you for having me this morning.
It's good. I'm glad that you could be here. We're gonna start our time together on the Made of Clay report, which is about getting to know the people of this area, their lives, and we're gonna start to this morning's session with a piece of music, the prologue and jet song in kind of abbreviated form from West Side Story, which was one of the pieces that Pat brought in with her. So I'm gonna start that now, and then we're gonna go to the interview. And that was the prologue and jet song from West Side Story, a version that was created for Richard Bernstein's 70th birthday. So that was selected by Pat Dutt as one of the songs for our show. Pat, why did you pick that song?
I selected that song because while I was growing up, my father used to listen to musicals. Uh-huh. And I think that started for him in 1941 when he went to the New York World's Fair, and he actually saw a musical. And because of that, we listened to like My Fair Lady, Oklahoma, West Side Story, and I still listen to musicals today, and my children could tell you about that
they're the background of your life on some level.
Yeah, absolutely. The background of my life. Or the music is too.
Yeah. No. That's neat. One of the ways that I've described for people to pick the music for this show is tell me what would be the soundtrack to your life if you had to have a soundtrack.
Yeah.
So neat. Yeah. So Pat, tell me a bit about yourself. Who are you?
That's a good question. From age 9. I wanted to be a scientist, and that was my goal, to be a scientist, and in particular, a geologist. I can't say that I'm a scientist anymore, but I did work as a scientist for many years, maybe 20 or 25 years, mm-hmm. and I guess I could elaborate on that if you want me to.
So it's not so much what we do as why we do it. That's who we are. What's meaningful? Yeah.
Okay. So I grew up outside of Buffalo, New York, mm-hmm. in a town called Orchard Park. I didn't grow up in the village of Orchard Park. I grew up out in the country. Mm-hmm. And
it's an important distinction.
It's an important distinction because we were kind of isolated.
Yeah.
And my parents, every summer, as a family, there were four children, all a year and a half apart, good, strict Catholic upbringing. We would go camping every summer. And one summer, when I was 9 years old, we happened to go to Yellowstone National Park. And we camped in a Nimrod camping trailer. I don't know if you're familiar with those. They're pop-ups, and they have canvas tops, and they snap in place. And on this trip to Yellowstone, I met a geologist. Mm-hmm. And the geologist was showing us rock samples and telling us, you know, how rocks formed. And I thought he showed us a piece of rhyolite and said, you know, like, describe to us that there was a story in rocks. And at that point, I just became intrigued with rocks and minerals, and I decided that I wanted to become a geologist. I wanted to become a scientist. Mm-hmm. And so I started collecting rocks and minerals. I would go back in the woods. We had a fairly deep woods behind our house. We had lived on 5.5 acres, and there were lots of creeks, so what would happen is the creeks would expose the shale, and you could go fossil hunting. And so I would hunt for fossils in the backwoods. And one of my grandmothers lived on the shores of Lake Erie, and I would also go fossil hunting there. And then I would take my fossils home, and I had one of these little books that I could use to identify fossils with, and I would identify brachiopods and trilobites. And that was how I spent a lot of my time identifying rocks. And every time we would go on a camping trip, I would pick up rocks and minerals, and I would go home, and I would try and identify them. So that's one of the parts of my life.
Right. And the way you told that story, where the geologist told you that there was a story locked in each of those rocks about how it came to be, that seems to have been the piece that kind of intrigued you, or at least that's what I heard in your voice. And that's a very bidding sort of way to a youth to kind of think about this. You know, look at your environment and see what maybe around there that you could come to know, that you could ferret out.
Yeah. Right. And also, you know, I was struck with the idea that that rocks were about facts too. Mm-hmm. And there was a difference between facts and opinions, and I wanted to study facts. That was where my mind was at that time.
Right. And you were about 9, you said.
I was 9.
And that's a good age for facts. I mean, neat. So, so that gives us a sense of your empiricism and kind of what you know kind of what drives you a little bit. I sense your passion as you tell your story. So, what brought you here to this area, and you know, how did you find your way to Ithaca?
It's a long story. Mm-hmm. I've lived in many places around the United States. Should I digress a little bit?
This whole show is one long digression, and we find the kernel, and then we move on to another digression.
Okay. So, getting back to my dream of being a geologist, when I graduated from college, I was 22 years old. 2 weeks later, I found myself in Houston. Houston, Texas, because that was the city, that was the place where geologists could find work. Mm-hmm. And what happened was my parents had an old Pinto that was sitting in their driveway out in the Buffalo snow for a couple of years, and they gave me the Pinto, and my father showed me how to change a tire. He showed me how to change the oil in the car. I had $600. My parents said goodbye. You're on your own. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And The launch from the nest. Yeah. And so a friend of mine came along with me for the trip. Unfortunately, she couldn't drive a standard. Mm-hmm. So it took us maybe 2 or 3 days to drive down to Houston. I think we slept maybe a couple hours throughout the whole ordeal. I say ordeal because I remember in Kentucky, the Pinto could barely make it up the hills, and we had to kind of sit back and let the car rest a little bit. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I made it down to Houston. I had one friend from college, who I knew down there, and he offered us a place to stay. And it was, he had a roommate, and his roommate, it turned out, was an ex-con, and actually was engaging in, you could say, risky behavior. So I very quickly found an apartment. But I remember my first night in Houston, sleeping in the Pinto with boxes of records and a box of books and a box of clothes surrounding me, and saying to myself, I need to find a place soon because I'm not going to live like this, and find a job soon. And that kind of relates to my upbringing. Again, here's another digression.
So how does that illustrate your upbringing?
Well, one of the mosaics of my life, which is one of the questions that you asked me, was when I was 6 years old, my mother was very ill, and she had rheumatic fever. And one of the treatments that that existed back then for rheumatic fever was to just have bed rest for a year. So when I was very young and my sister and two brothers were young, we were sort of left on our own. We would get ourselves up in the morning and go to school, make our breakfast, make our lunch. And so because of that upbringing, and this lasted for about a year, we became really self-reliant and responsible for our own lives. And I don't think my parents ever sat us down and had a discussion about it. It was sort of like, well, if you want to go to school today, then you better be ready to go to school, and you better get yourself ready. And
it's a lot of responsibility.
It's a lot of responsibility, but that's the way that it was. As my mother got better, we did all the, I guess you could say, like middle class things that people do. We took piano lessons. We took instrument lessons. We went to a Catholic school. I went to a Catholic school for actually 12 years, and my mother cared a lot about education, and that's also been a thread throughout my life, that education is really important to having a good life. My mother made it through 1 year of college, and I was actually the first female in my family to graduate from college.
Wow.
And others have followed.
Are you the oldest of your four siblings? Or?
I'm the second.
The second.
And I have an older brother. We're all a year and a half apart. And we've all either become scientists or engineers. My father was an engineer. He died about 9 years ago. He worked for Bethlehem Steel, and he worked in the coke ovens. And his car, I mean, I'm just like bringing up random memories. His car was covered inside and outside with coal dust because, you know, this was back in the 60s and the 70s, and there weren't a lot of environmental laws regulating the steel companies back then. The US EPA didn't actually become an organization until 1970.
Right.
And I mean, I have distinct memories of driving through Buffalo and driving through clouds of sulfur and coal dust because there were no regulations back then.
So that was Houston, Texas, and you had a few other stops along the way.
So in Houston, you know, because of my self-reliance and sense of responsibility, I found jobs right away. I didn't find a job and as a geologist right away. I worked in a pool hall. I worked as a cocktail waitress.
You kept yourself going.
I kept myself going because when I came down to Houston, I had $600. I remember that that number, which was enough to pay for a month's rent, a security deposit, and food and gas, you know, to keep me going for about a month. But I had to find a job right away. And I did, and I found jobs. At the same time, it also occurred to me that if I was going to work as a geologist, that it would be a good idea for me to have more schooling. So when I came to Houston in June of 1978, And by September of 1978, I was enrolled in the University of Houston, and I was working full-time and taking classes at night in, you know, in hopes of getting a master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
So...
And professionally, what kinds of work did you do, and when did you come to Ithaca? What year did you come to Ithaca?
Well, okay, back to Houston.
Yeah.
So I stayed in Houston until 1985 or 1986. Now, mm-hmm. I can't even remember.
Yeah, yeah, no, I know. It happens.
but I did find a job as a petroleum geologist. I worked as a petroleum geologist for about 4 years, but I found that it wasn't really satisfying work to me. And the company I worked for, Gulf Oil, which no longer exists, for the last 2 years that I was working for Gulf Oil, Gulf Oil was in the throes of a takeover, and it was eventually taken over by Chevron Oil. And it was, I think, one of the most unhappy times of my life, because I didn't like my job, but I didn't think that I could do anything else. I was married at the time, and I was starting to see, like, hairline fractures in my marriage. In order to relieve my stress, I would run. I ran a lot. In fact, I ran obsessively. But it helped me to relieve a lot of the stress that I was feeling.
And cope.
And at the same time, I was still taking classes at the University of Houston. I had gotten my master's degree, and I decided to take writing classes because it was really difficult for me to write my thesis, because I always thought that I don't need to know how to write. I'm a scientist. I just need to know about the science end of things, and I don't need to know how to write. And I had a really, really difficult time on my thesis, and I decided, well, I need some work here, and that's when I started taking writing classes at the University of Houston, and in fact, creative writing classes. And I started keeping a journal and writing short stories, and actually had a short story published like in 1982 or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So what happened was, when Gulf Oil was taken over by Chevron, Chevron approached me and said, do you want to work for us? Do you want to work out in California? And after a conversation with my husband, I decided that I didn't want to move to California, I didn't want to do geology anymore. And so I quit, and we were still in Houston, and I found a job teaching science in a middle school. And it was teaching science in a Catholic school. So they didn't require that you had a teaching degree. So I could teach science without a teaching degree. And I took a huge pay cut, and I worked three times as hard as how I had worked at the oil company. And I absolutely loved what I was doing.
Wow.
But what happened was, my husband at the time got a job in Washington, D.C., so I taught for a semester and then moved to Washington, D.C., where I worked as a science consultant for what's called a Beltway Bandit, a consulting agency, and looking at nitrate and...
I haven't heard that term in a number of years, Beltway Bandit. That must have been a term from the 80s or 70s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was a satisfying job, but I was in an 80-mile commute every day, and it was a little nerve-wracking. Because you'd have to, we lived in Maryland, and I was working in West Virginia, and there was no easy way to go across. You couldn't go diagonally across Washington, D.C. You had to go all the way around. And so we were there for about 10 months, and then we moved to Madison, Wisconsin, and my husband at the time had a postdoc. And I started looking around for a job. And by then, I was 30 years old, and we were also thinking about having children. And I remember that there were two job options available to me. One was to go out on a hazardous waste site and collect soil samples. And the other was to work for the University of Wisconsin in the engineering professional development, writing articles on underground storage tanks. Because, and this was in 1987, 1986, because...
And that issue was really live.
Yeah, because it was in 1986 that the EPA actually created the Office of Underground Storage Tanks, and they started regulating spills from basically gasoline tanks.
Right.
And they wanted someone to write a newsletter on groundwater and soil contamination. And so I went to the University of Wisconsin Engineering Professional Development and talked with someone for about a half an hour. And he said, okay, I'll give you 40 hours and you produce the first newsletter. And I ended up having this job for about 20 years as we moved around the country.
But you did it from wherever you were living.
I could do it remotely, and it was a part-time job, and it enabled me to bring up my children. Mm-hmm. So what happened was my first child was born in Madison, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
My second child was born in Bismarck, North Dakota.
Wow.
And my third child was born outside of St. Paul, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we moved around the country, I was able to keep my job and write fiction. And raise my children and be at home with my children, which I felt was really, it was really important to me to be with them as much as I could.
Yes, yes.
But, yeah.
And, well, let's take a little music break. What would you like to go to? Trumpeter's Lullaby or Sound of Silence or Singing in the Rain? What
Trumpeter's Lullaby.
Okay, we're going to do that. And... let me just pull that one up. That was Trumpeter's Lullaby, and I inadvertently sliced into it. I was going to bring it down a little bit later, but anyway, these accidents do happen. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the morning show with the Monday Made of Clay Report, and our guest this morning is Pat Dutt. And Pat is describing a bit about her life, and she was talking about the travels and the journey she was on, and we were just about ready to come to Ithaca. So what brought you to Ithaca, and what keeps you here?
So I had actually been visiting Ithaca since about 1982, and that's the year that I was married, and my ex-husband is actually from Ithaca.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would visit here every year, and I always thought that Ithaca was a beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
and a fun place and a small city. And so let's see, in 1996 We decided to move here, and at that time, my ex-husband was working for the USGS. So we had a job here, he had a job here, and I carried my job from the University of Wisconsin with me. And I think the first year here was pretty traumatic,
uh-huh.
because we ended up getting divorced, and it was hard on my kids.
Right.
How
old were your kids at that point?
My kids were like 4, 6, and 9.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to shuffle They had to do the school shuffle. They were in different schools.
Right.
We rented a house in Northeast, and they started out in the Northeast schools, and then we moved to a house in Cayuga Heights. So my one daughter ended up being in four different schools in really in about a year and a half.
Wow.
And it was hard for them, and along with the divorce, they made it through it.
Right.
They made it through it, and I think they learned a lot of skills. And so what happened was, and so I was divorced in 1998, and I moved to the West Hill in 1998, where I live today, and I put a down payment down on a house. And I guess your question is, what keeps me here? I should say, initially, I didn't want to be here when I first moved here. I don't have any family here.
Right.
Most of my family has left New York State, and I didn't have any family here in Ithaca, and I didn't have any friends here either. In fact, that's another factor that's come into play in my life. When you move around the country so much, when you move every 2 years or so,
right,
you don't really have the opportunity to make a lot of friends, and which is one of the reasons why writing has become so important in my life. But I wanted to leave, but when I discovered that it wasn't going to be possible to leave because of legal reasons, I thought, okay, now I have to adjust, and I have to stay here, and I have to make the best life possible for my children. And so
that's another side of the Ithaca story that people don't often hear, is that not everybody wants to be here, but they make a life here.
And and it's actually turned around so that I actually really love being here. But one of the first things that I noticed, and I love where I live, I love my neighborhood, but one of the first things that occurred to me was, I live on West Haven Road, I have these little kids, and the speed limit is 40 miles an hour, which means that cars don't travel at 40 miles an hour. They're like traveling at 50 miles an hour.
Right.
So one of the first things that we did, my older daughter and I, was we walked around the neighborhood to get signatures. We created a petition to lower the speed limit. Mm-hmm. So this is where I started doing some activism. I finally, at this point in my life, I felt that I was living in a community, in a community that mattered to me, because I was not going to be leaving in a year or two. And so I decided at that point that I wanted to put some effort into making my community the best place possible. And I wanted to transmit that to my children.
Right, and they're getting older at that point, and you need to do that quickly because that's an early life skill.
Yeah, I've always believed that children follow your example. Like they follow what you do. Mm-hmm. They don't always listen to what you say,
right,
but they're always, always watching what you do. So my older daughter and I went up and down the road, collected these petitions, sent them to the town, and nothing happened. This was in 1998. And neighbors at that time said, oh, there's no way you're going to get them to change the speed limit. It's never going to happen. But what happened was, a couple of years ago, we actually got the speed limit changed to 30 miles an hour. And it was not an easy process. Mm-hmm. It involved having an engineer from Syracuse come out and drive up and down the road. It involved a couple of meetings among the neighbors there, but we did affect the speed limit. We did get it changed, and that occurred to me that, well, maybe we could do other things in the neighborhood too, by meeting and discussing other things that we wanted changed.
And so what have you pursued?
Well, so in 2007, I lost a job, and because I lost that job, I was on unemployment, and I had a little bit of extra time, and I thought, if I'm going to be on unemployment, I need to give back to the community. And on the West Hill, the West Hill is really fractured in terms of community. There's no elementary school. If you live on the West Hill, you go to three different elementary schools. Mm-hmm. You go to two different middle schools. And so the community itself is fractured. There's a city portion and the town portion, although I believe that the city and the town are contiguous.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me that we that if we're going to solve some of our problems, like traffic problems, development problems, and other problems, that we needed to work together. But in order to work together, we needed to have some venue to meet together. Mm-hmm. So a neighbor and I started Ithaca West Hill Community, and this was in 2007. And it's evolved over the years to Ithaca West. Mm-hmm. And it's a listserv and a website, and it's where people can meet and talk about issues, in particular on the West Hill. Mm-hmm. And because I believe that everything starts with the conversation, so if you start talking about the issues that we have, people bring in their ideas, and mm-hmm. maybe we can make the community a little bit better. And I'm looking at my sheet right here. So some of the things that, by the way, the listserv is run by someone who supports it himself, Andres.
Right.
Who, I don't know if he's been on the show.
Andres Ozalons, yes. Yes. He has been on the show as well. Yes.
Yeah. 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 Well, he's the guy behind the listserv. Yeah. But so some of the things that we've done, and I don't know how much you talked about.
No, we didn't talk about this.
Oh. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. So anyway, so there's a listserv. It's free to join. Anybody on the West Hill can join it. If you have lost a dog, you can throw up a message on the listserv and say, I lost my dog. Have you seen this dog? You can help a neighbor in distress. For instance, a neighbor on the West Hill recently had a fire, and someone sent out a posting saying, you know, does anybody have expertise in you know, rebuilding houses, or,
right.
you know of people who can help this person? We tried carpooling, mm-hmm. which didn't work, but we're still, you know, working on that. Mm-hmm. We share things. Like, for instance, I've found people from I'm also a permaculturalist. Mm-hmm. I grow a lot of my own food. I found someone in the city who had a lot of leaves, and in terms of sharing resources, this person drops his leaves off at my house, so my front yard is, at least part of it, is full of leaves. Mm-hmm. And wood chips, and so we're sharing resources.
Right.
What else does a listserv do? You can announce community dinners. Mm-hmm. Any information about classes, when the mayoral race was mm-hmm. on in Ithaca, we profiled the candidates. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of like, we disseminate information
right.
that's of interest to the community.
Right. And it's an informal structure. And one of the things that makes Tompkins County and Ithaca particularly unique, in upstate New York, we're the only place that's doubled in size in the last 50 years. And the bulk of that doubling has been permanent residents and not students. And so we don't have an innate sense of community or the kind of communication structures. We lack that. In fact, we're a little bit community challenged. But we've been community challenged here since the Civil War because of the social status and the hierarchy of class and all this stuff that's dominated here in manufacturing. This was a manufacturing town predominantly until the late 70s. And people don't realize these things. So you're stepping in as part of your personal narrative, having lived a lot of different places and finally planting yourself here. But you're also planting yourself in a place that hasn't had a really good track record of community, not in these informal ways that you're talking about. And that's neat.
Yeah.
That's really, really neat.
The other places that I lived in, though, it didn't seem as possible to have the grassroots efforts that you have here in Ithaca. Like, for instance, you know, to get this listserv started, I made flyers, mm-hmm. and I walked up and down West Haven Road. I can't tell you how many times. And I found other people to distribute flyers. And mm-hmm. basically, the flyer said, like, we're an organization on the West Hill. Join our organization, loose organization, very right. loose organization. Right, right. But this way you can have a voice, because the West Hill hasn't had a voice.
Right, right. And many groups in Ithaca have not had a voice for similar sorts of reasons. We're fractured. We're a community where people really don't know each other. Now, what you're doing is straddling that space between, it's organizing. And that's the space between society and community. It's not really on the community side. It's not really on the society side. But you're trying to get people organized around interests. and getting their voices heard. And in community, it's more about just being people and being whole people and being safe and being able to express your concerns and share them in an informal way without having to have it so organized, because people will step up to the plate. But we're not there yet. We're just at this kind of organizing juncture, and that's a neat thing to see that you're doing. Because we've about 25 minutes left, and I know that we've got some really big things that we want to talk about too. So what are some experiences? What are a couple of experiences that have really shaped your life? And I know that you want to talk about a couple of them. So let's start.
So other than being basically on my own at 6 years old, mm-hmm. Another experience that shaped my life was losing a job that I really loved, that I had prepared for and gone back to school for when I was in my 50s. Mm-hmm. And how I lost the job, and it took me I lost it in 2007, and it took me a long time to understand what my role was mm-hmm. in losing this job, but I felt that it was important that I speak up for people who I worked with, because in my job, the people who I worked with helped me to be successful. Mm-hmm. And there was this point that came that if I didn't speak up for them, then I felt that I would be a hypocrite. Mm-hmm. And also, it's always in the back of my mind that my children are watching my actions.
Right.
And if I say something but I don't follow through and I don't take action, then my life doesn't mean very much. So,
or it's not consistent, it's not coherent.
Yeah, and it's also the fact, I guess, growing up as a Catholic, that every night before I go to bed, I kind of analyze my conscience. Mm-hmm. And I ask myself, like, what have I done that was right today? What have I done that was wrong? And mm-hmm. how have I moved the world forward in a good way? Mm-hmm. And that's just that's like an intrinsic part of me, who I am. And so I lost that job. And then, because I spoke up, and it was the first time, I was in my 50s, that I had spoken up for anyone. And that kind of changed my life, because what happened was I got other jobs. It was always easy for me to get jobs because I had a science background. And that's always, always helped me. And I got other jobs, and I would And I remember distinctly, and this is kind of a funny story. So I got another job working at a high tech place, and I had worked for 7 months at this high tech company near the airport, and every single day I was there. I'm like, I'm one of these people. I never miss a day of work. I'm rarely sick. I'm mm-hmm. I'm really self disciplined, and so I said to my boss, "Okay, Memorial Day is coming up. I should get Memorial Day off because I've worked here for 7 months and I've worked overtime." And my boss looked at me and said, "But you don't have the correct paper signed, and therefore you don't get that holiday." And I was really infuriated. And what happened was, so I was working in a lab and writing technical manuals, and basically he said, "Okay, no more overtime for you. You can't work overtime anymore." Which was sort of a blow to me, because at that time I was raising my three kids. I was the mm-hmm. sole provider. I basically a single mom since I moved here to Ithaca mm-hmm. Because of illnesses of my ex-husband. Mm-hmm. So cut to the chase. I kept losing hours and I kept losing days. And at the end of my stay at this company, I even lost my office, and I was sitting in the hallway so that my boss could look over my shoulder and see what I was doing on my computer screen, which was I was looking for other jobs. And I did leave that job, and I found other jobs.
Right.
And for a while there, I was kind of worried about finding the job that I have mm-hmm. now. And it was actually, I worked for Kuga Landscape Company, mm-hmm. and I've been there for 4 years, and I started out kind of low on the totem pole, mm-hmm. and over the years, I've learned the business a little bit. Mm-hmm. I now do commercial estimating and some residential mm-hmm. estimating, but at the same time, I still answer phones and fill out invoices.
Right. And your story is a beautiful and painful illustration of the fact that, you know, we're going to have many, many different jobs over the course of a lifetime, and we're going to have three or four different careers, if, you know, most of us, that are very different kinds of work, at least. And all of us, at some point or another, are going to get fired, you know, going to get let go. And sometimes it's going to be for speaking up, and other times it's just going to be for all sorts of reasons for things that we did or didn't do, or nothing at all having to do with the climate, the economic climate. One of the things you were talking about, you're kind of searching for community, and some of the literature on whistleblowers or people who speak up, is that if your friends and your family really understand what you're doing, then you survive the process with more resilience. You end up on your feet. You almost never survive with the job where you were, but you end up on your feet financially and emotionally, and the depression and the loss is not quite as severe if everybody around you understands what you're doing, even if they don't necessarily agree with you. But if they agree with you, all the better. But if they understand why, then they can be supportive, even if they wouldn't do it themselves. And it sounds like you were trying to bring your family on board and even some of your coworkers.
Yeah. I think it's actually a good thing to have many different careers in life because then you learn about things that you would never have learned about. I mean, mm-hmm. I knew nothing before I worked for Cuga Landscape. Mm-hmm. And actually, I believe the reason I have the job at Cuga Landscape is because one of the first people that I met when I moved here was David Fernandez and Elizabeth Lawson. Mm-hmm. David is the owner of Cuga Landscape. And I during my periods when I didn't have jobs, I was always in school or even here, like taking remote classes at TC3 or learning mm-hmm. how to write grants or something. But I happened to take a permaculture class during my last period of unemployment. Mm-hmm. And I called up Elizabeth and I said, "Hey, Elizabeth, I want to tell David about, you know, permaculture plants. He should start mm-hmm. selling them at Cuga Landscape." And what happened was Elizabeth said, "Oh, David wants to meet you." Met David. 15 minutes later, David said, "Would you like a job?" Mm-hmm. And that's how I got my latest job.
That's right. And what we're doing as a culture now, I think, is we're in this very painful transition, you know, from being people who are oriented towards a market where all that matters is our skills around a particular technical set, to being generally skillful people who can land with economic value in a variety of different settings. But it's because we've shaped our lives to be more widely and broadly applicable to the kinds of things that need to be done around us. That's a different mindset than what we had in the 20th century, where you took on a skill and tried to ride it for a 40-year career. It's just a completely different mindset.
Yeah, my father, case in point, worked for Bethlehem Steel for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And at that time, like, that's how things worked. Right. You stayed in a job for 30 years. You didn't have to improve your skills. Right. Now you have to take whatever opportunities arise. You have to take advantage of those opportunities and you know, educate yourself on a whole spectrum of different issues.
And have a more flexible sense of who you are as a person.
Yeah.
And I think we're going back to pre-modern times in this, and it's very painful because we want the productivity and the affluence that came with modernity and specialization, but we need to be more generalists now and more flexible, and that's a very hard transition to live into. Can I switch to Simon and Garfunkel for a second? And then we will go to another set of questions. And this is The Sound of Silence.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
restless dreams I walked alone. Narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stabbed by the flash of a neon light, split the night and touch the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, people writing songs that voices never share. No one did disturb the sound of silence. Fool said I, you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words that I might teach you. Take my arms that I might reach you. But my words, like silent raindrops, fell. Echoing the wind of silence. And the people bowed and prayed to the neon god they made. And the sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, the tenement halls, whispering. Silence.
And that was the Simon and Garfunkel with Sounds of Silence. And our guest this morning on Made of Clay Report is Pat Dutt, and you're listening to WRFI Watkins Glen, Ithaca. So, Pat, you'd said that you independence, a greater sense of independence at age six, losing a job for reasons that taking and finding a voice and taking a stance, but there's a third issue that you wanted to talk about a formative experience. And
yeah, one of the reasons I wanted to come on your show mm-hmm. was because I wanted to speak on behalf of mentally ill people
and those who love them.
Yeah. Yes. So, a person in my family has been mentally ill for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so I've been thinking about the issue of mental illness in a very deep and comprehensive sense. Mm-hmm. And I've come to a few conclusions about mentally ill people. They really crave companionship, and they would really want to have friends, mm-hmm. but because of a mental illness, it's often not possible. So let me digress for a moment.
Sure.
So I read a lot, and one of the books that I just recently finished reading was An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, mm-hmm. What Going to Space Taught Me About Ingenuity, Determination, and Being Prepared for Anything. And it's a great book mm-hmm. By Chris Hadfield. And one of the things that struck me about this book was that, so Chris was in the International Space Station for 5 months, right? And so you're living in zero gravity for 5 months. And the rules of living in the International Space Station are much different from the rules of living on Earth. And you have to compensate for lack of gravity. In other words, you eat differently. And everything that you do is a little bit differently. For instance, he was playing the guitar, and he had to compensate, like he was overrunning the strings, or he didn't have to, his guitar would float away from him, and so he had to adjust to these certain rules. And you know, when he came back to Earth, it was very painful for him to, since he was gone for 5 months, mm-hmm. It was very painful for him to walk.
Right.
Because
you can't have the strength to hold yourself
up. You don't
anymore.
Have the strength, but his feet actually physically hurt because there had been no pressure on mm-hmm. his feet for 5 months. And the idea is if you're in space for 5 months, then it's going to take you 5 months to adjust to life on Earth. And for a mentally ill person, has rules that are different from, I would say, a normal person's rules and mm-hmm. Rules of life. And a mentally ill person has to adjust to these rules. He has to adjust to living in society, and what these rules are not always clear. For instance, you might be a mentally ill person might be in psychosis, and that just means that mm-hmm. there are breaks from reality. Sometimes there are such severe breaks from reality that you need to be hospitalized, and you have to be given medicines and therapy. And when you come out of the hospital, you still need to be able to take care of yourself. You still need to be able to be on your meds, have therapy, and also have a support group. I mm-hmm. mean, people who are mentally ill, the people who survive mental illness and actually have a good life are the ones who not only have the meds, the therapy, but support groups. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With myself, I've had a close group of friends who have supported me through this process mm-hmm. of helping my family member negotiate through the hospitals and the mental health experts. And I know I wanted to mention something else.
Yeah. And what I want to say briefly is that one of the things that I've discovered in Shared Journeys and the place that I work for is that it takes 30 to 70 people in your life at varying degrees of closeness for you to have the community, the informal relationships that will make it possible for you to thrive. Of those 30 to 70 people at any given time, half of them are preoccupied with somebody else in their life. About a quarter of them are caught up in their own stuff. And about a quarter of them are available. So the numbers are really large in order to have enough redundancy to be able to have people to fall back on and to be available to others when you need to be available to others. But so we don't think as a community. We tend to think as a society where you have a special group or you have a special product or you have a special, you know, a support group or a technical thing. But there are these other sides which are just informal where we are just being good citizens, trying to be good people to others who may need us, and when we need them to ask and to give and to receive with care. Anyway, right. You were going to move on to something else.
Well, yeah, and I was going to talk about some of the resources mm-hmm. for mentally ill people and for the people who love them. And one is this organization called SPACE. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And SPACE stands for Starlight Peer Advocacy Center for Empowerment. And it's an organization that has space in the Henry St. John building
yes.
on Clinton Street. And if you don't mind, I'll read their mission statement. Okay, the mission of SPACE is to offer people who use or have used mental health services a place to pull together to support themselves, to socialize, and improve their lives in their own way. It's run by peers. SPACE strives to create a relaxed environment where members can feel free from drugs, alcohol, and harassment. It is by socializing with our peers, educating the public, and working together in operation of the center that we seek to open up to new friendships, help create the stigma surrounding those with a mental health diagnosis, and achieve our limitless human potential and reach for the stars.
Yes, yes, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. And that is, and that's one of the venues and one of the ways in which people can sustain themselves. How do you sustain yourself? What do you do to kind of keep yourself in balance and to keep yourself flexible?
Okay, so I actually wrote down a list. Okay, I've been a runner since my 20s, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and I love running in the dark,
yep.
and I love running up and down West Haven Road. So if you see a person at 5 o'clock in the morning running up and down West Haven Road with a dog, that's me. Read. I like reading has saved me so many times when I have a list of authors who are my go-to authors that when I'm having a particularly stressful period of my life, I will read that author. In fact, James McConkie, Court of Memory and Crossroads. I'll always go back to that book. And I have many, many other authors. I write. In fact, I've published about a dozen short stories. And I'm putting a book of my short stories on Amazon CreateSpace pretty soon. And the title of the short stories, the title is 14,000 Reasons to Be Happy. So you can imagine what the stories are about.
Yep.
I meditate almost every day. I cook. I try to make new food. I grow food. I grow a lot of my own food. I listen to the radio, 88.1.
Yes.
I listen to music a lot. I don't watch TV. I haven't watched TV since about 1978 because I think it desensitizes me and I don't want to be desensitized. So I don't watch TV. I have good friends now because I've been in this area for 15 years. I've made good friends and it's kind of, it's unusual for
and
me.
I'm going to challenge something you just said there. You have good friends because you've been here a certain amount of time. No. You have good friends because you've made yourself available to other people and you've asked other people to be available to you. And that's how we make good friends. Time doesn't do it by itself. Although, I mean, it can. It helps because we find the ways to do it. But one of the things that's lacking in this region is a capacity to quickly strike up conversations and find out who we are so that we could be the friends that we need to be to each other. And what you're doing is yours is a testimony by hook or by crook. You're going to get those friends, and you've got them. And that's a neat witness.
And I've actually met a lot of people from the listserv, too, from the West Hill listserv, who have become my good friends, such as Andres.
Like you say, you have to talk to each other in order to...
You have to take a risk.
Yes.
Because it's always a risk that you're going to... Yeah.
And you had picked a song, Rubber Band Man.
And this is
a little bit about flexibility and risk taking and emotional availability, and I think the way I got it from you, and I listened to it again.
And I wanted to add one thing why I chose that song.
Yeah.
So in November, I was walking down the corridors of the behavioral unit at Cuyahoga Medical Center, and I was talking to this close family member about being on the show and saying that I wanted to talk about mental illness. And was that a problem with him if I talked about mental illness? And he said, no, it's something that you have to talk about. Just don't say who I am. Mm-hmm. And we talked about what's some of the songs that I should play, and he said, yeah, Rubber Band Man, because it's about flexibility, that you always have to adjust to your situation. You have to be flexible in life. That flexibility is an indication of your intelligence. And if you can adjust to just about any situation, then that's a sign of intelligence. And you can figure things out yourself, or as much as you can yourself. So like you never stop trying to have a good life despite what hurdles are in your way.
Thank you, Pat. It's been wonderful to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And this is the Made of Clay Report. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. And our guest this hour has been Pat Dutt. And we're going to listen now to Rubber Band Man at the suggestion of the loved one in her life who thought we ought to hear that. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca.